Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer is usually here the rest of the week. I am your guest host here for the remaining hour and a half of the Dynamic Duo, Morgan Reynolds. I'm sitting in for Jim today, Wednesday and Thursday, and I have, I believe, an exciting lineup of guests, beginning with Dr. Gary North today, Dr. Pam Fried, the Executive Director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia, tomorrow, and then on Thursday, Dr. Judy Wood, a leading 9/11 researcher and PhD engineer, along with John Hutchison, famed for the Hutchison effect, sometimes termed an anti-gravity effect. Well, my guest today is Gary North. I'm glad we got on, Gary. He is a prolific and marvelous writer, and I believe he has a PhD in history. We'll find out in a minute. He has been labeled a Christian economist. He's certainly a financial advisor. He's got a website, which is GaryNorth.com, which is at least part a subscription website. Gary, welcome to the Dynamic Duo. How are you today?
Well, it's a good day so far for me, not so good for the stock market.
Yeah, I notice it's down over 3%. Gold and silver were down, too.
Yeah, the gold stocks were down substantially, but gold was down about 1.5%.
1.5%.
Yeah, the stocks did, of course, a lot worse because they generally are more volatile. But, yeah, it was a tough day for the market and for obvious reasons, and it sure does look like we're moving into recession.
Okay, I want to talk about that a little bit more. Why don't you give us a thumbnail biography on Gary North?
Well, basically, I've been in the sometimes called the hard money movement for a little over 40 years, I guess, really closer to 45. I was first brought into this, if anybody did, it was by Professor Hans Senholtz, who was the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College for many, many years, and he was a follower of Ludwig von Mises. And he was one of the very first people I ever heard who predicted that Gresham's law would take over for silver and all the silver would disappear. And I believed him and bought a lot of silver. Within 18 months, it all disappeared. So I became convinced that free market economics was a predictable phenomenon and you could actually make money using it. So that was pretty much how I got into this business.
Did you have any connection to Grove City College?
No, I never did personally. I was with the Foundation for Economic Education up in Irvington on Hudson back in the early 1970s.
He eventually became director of that, wasn't he?
Well, Leonard Reed was the man who founded it and was the senior man for many years. And then since then, Senholtz for a time also was a director at FEE. So it's an old organization. And in the good old days, it was just about the only strong free market organization teaching people the basics of free market economics. But, of course, now there are many organizations doing it, and that's all to the good.
But your PhD actually is in history?
Yes, I did my doctoral dissertation on the concept of property in Puritan New England, the whole changing concept of property rights in the early part of American history, how they moved from basically a kind of mercantilism or medievalism to pretty much a free market system just because they were forced into it by the failures of government controls over and over again.
Yeah, the exigencies of the harsh frontier led them to capitalism, I gather.
Well, there are a lot of reasons for it, but one thing they sure found out is that whenever they tried to control the market, all they got for their trouble was shortages. And finally, they did reduce a lot of the controls, and you began to see this tremendous period of economic growth in the United States.
What university was that?
I was at the University of California, and I was at the Riverside campus.
Oh, I was on the faculty there for a couple of years.
Is that so?
It's right. I got to think back now. That would have been right around 1970.
Yeah, that was about the time I left. My main professor there, actually, I did two of them. One was Galstead, Edwin Galstead, who was a religious expert, and the other was a sociologist named Robert Nisbet. And Nisbet had a tremendous influence on me personally, very conservative sociologist, which back in those days, like, there were five.
they were in a small room together.
Yeah, they sure were. So I've been at this a while, and I've watched bad policies come and go and then usually get worse. I guess the thing that really got me into it the most was when I first went to Washington. I was Ron Paul's research assistant when he first came to Congress in that first year, and that certainly gave me what I would call a close-up view of how the federal government works, and mostly it works poorly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was certainly a tremendous education for me, and Ron Paul, in obviously this year, has gotten a tremendous amount of publicity, much greater than I would have believed even 6 months ago, that he has become a kind of internet phenomenon, which I don't think anybody, including him, believed was going to be possible. So in that respect, I'm somewhat optimistic. I think you've got a hard core of people who will listen to free market ideas today, and furthermore, they now have, through the internet, a way to communicate with each other and to get training and exchange views with each other, and that is just a technological miracle.
Yeah, it's a wonderful tool that creates a decentralized exchange of information, which is all to the advantage of our side.
It certainly is.
Let's get your comment. Today is Super Tuesday following the Super Bowl. We got 24 state primaries in play, and on the Democrat side, we got Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, and on the Republican side, the leaders are looks like McCain is going to cruise to victory, but McCain versus Mitt Romney is the one on his heels. What in the world kind of a set of choices is this? I mean, Ron Paul, he's certainly got a national following, but he's been doing, what, 2 and 3%?
Yeah, that's right. And although in some states he's done better. Well, the way I look at it, Morgan, we've got a situation where through the primary system since now, as an historian, I would take it back certainly to the late 1890s. The only guy who has sneaked in who really hadn't been vetted by what I would call the powers that be was Goldwater. And he did sneak up on them and stunned them. And, of course, the media turned against him immediately, and the whole Eastern Republican establishment was perfectly content to see him go down to defeat and Lyndon Johnson become the victor. But remember, the tremendous result of that was the fact that there were about 12,500 names of donors who'd given more than $50. And they were public domain, and Richard Viguerie went in with a staff of ladies and got at least 10,000 of those names. And that became the basis of Viguerie's mailing list empire, and within a relatively brief period of time, Reagan was elected, primarily as a result of the growth of the conservative movement based on that mailing list. Now, Ron Paul's mailing list is vastly larger now than what Goldwater's was. So as I see it, we do have a chance as things become much more difficult economically, and as the promises of the government become much more obviously false.
Okay, we will rejoin Gary North on the other side of the break. Weekend today, I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim. And I'm having a conversation here with Dr. Gary North. And Gary, you mentioned that you could not recall a congressman with a national constituency, a House rep like Ron Paul, but you mentioned Howard Buffett, who in the 40s and early 50s, the father of Warren Buffett, allegedly the second wealthiest man in the world, was a stirring old right, isolationist and proud of it, free market, laissez-faire, private property. Quite an interesting connection. I wasn't aware of that. And he was a trenchant critic of war, imperialism, the centralization of power, just like Ron Paul is.
As far as I can tell, in the 20th century, there have only been really two guys like them. Warren Buffett's father, Howard, was an influential congressman from influential in terms of his local constituency, but not nationally. And he was a gold standard man. He did not trust the Federal Reserve. He did not trust the expansion of government under Harry Truman. Unfortunately, his son did not adopt his father's worldview, which is too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Ron is the only other guy that I can find in really in the second half of the 20th century who pretty much took the same limited government position and voted for that position consistently. The difference is, of course, he now has, for the first time, a national constituency because of the Internet.
Right.
And so this is going to change, or at least has the potential of changing local politics if his people will stick and get involved locally. Then as you have a period, which I think you're inevitably going to have, in which money ceases to buy the same amount of goods, you'll get controls, you get price controls. Essentially, the government is going to will have to default in one way or other on the many promises that it has given to the public. And when that happens, when the checks stop, when they start bouncing, when mm-hmm. the checks from Washington start bouncing, people will then be forced to reconsider the relevance of the welfare state system. And at that point, then you hope that there will be people locally who will be committed to limited government and shrinking the welfare state. And I can't see any group more likely to be the local people of influence than the people who have supported Ron Paul.
It brings to mind the Soviet Union. It's there. It's a big monster, seemingly sturdy. It's the Rock of Gibraltar, which I guess is not what it would seem either. But and the next day, it's not there. I mean, isn't this going to end with a bang instead of some kind of gradualism?
I think it is more likely to do that, but then predicting history is a lot more difficult than writing history. But my assumption is that short of some tremendous national disaster, such as, and the one I always worry about most because it's technologically feasible, would be a terrorist attack, say, with airborne anthrax in a major city or two major cities. Now, that could be totally paralytic because of what it would do to the banking system. But short of that, which is technologically feasible, we hope it just will not happen, short of that, I see the steady bankruptcy of the federal government. We have a president. He has proposed a $3.1 trillion budget.
I saw that.
This fiscal, $3.1 trillion. Now, look at what the argument is. The only argument he's getting from the Democrats is that it's not big enough. He's proposing to cut $200 billion of Medicare spending, and so Harry Reid says, well, he's not going to get that. So here we have a debate between a Republican of $3.1 trillion and the Democrats presumably going to push for $3.3 trillion. And with a recession coming, you're talking about a potential deficit of anywhere from $400 to $500 billion.
Yeah, so, I remember years ago, my dissertation advisor, I said, look, you can just put your hand, your forearm across the years on the scale here and look at federal spending or federal deficits, and you couldn't tell who was in office, really.
Oh.
So it goes back to what George Wallace said about what kind of a difference is there between the Dems and the Republicans. One thing caught my ear there, Gary. I wanted to go revisit this thing about you said that Barry Goldwater really was outside the vetted, approved candidates by the powers that be. Wasn't Reagan really an outsider? And you hear these stories that You know, why did Reagan appoint George Herbert Walker Bush as his vice presidential candidate unless the powers that be, I've heard this story may not be true, but it captures the right spirit. Namely, David Rockefeller calls Reagan into his office and says, you're going to appoint Bush as your vice president. What do you mean? Well, otherwise we're going to dump all, we got plenty of blackmail stuff on you. You know, you're going to just go ahead and do it. And then, of course, what, within 60 days of his administration, he was the victim of an assassination attempt. So wasn't Reagan outside the approved, wasn't he an outsider?
To some extent he was, that's true. I know that story, and Morgan, I know exactly what did happen, and Morgan, I ain't going to say it on the air because the two guys who were the facilitators are still alive, and they have plenty of money to sue. But yeah, I know what happened, I know when it happened, and I had a tip off from the guy who actually saw it, who was...
That's too bad, but you can't give us the...
However, the reality is such that it's close enough to what you've said, and yes, Bush was forced on the ticket, and Baker was the administrator. But remember, in the case of Reagan, they didn't want him. They believed that with Bush on the ticket that it could be controlled.
Yes.
But what they didn't figure was that on two issues he would not be moved. He would not be moved on cutting marginal tax rates, and he got that through.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue was he was convinced that the Soviet Union was vulnerable in Afghanistan, and he was determined to bring it down if he possibly could. And I believe he did do it, and it was the Stingers that did it, and it wasn't Charlie Wilson who convinced him. We know actually who it was who convinced him. It was the head of the French Secret Service who convinced him, who had a meeting with him in October of 1980 and said, if you will give Stingers to the Afghans, they will defeat the Soviets, and within a year the Soviet Union will disintegrate. And the guy who was there at that meeting was Arnold Dvorchkov.
Oh, yeah, of the Washington Times, yeah.
That's right, and he wrote the obituary of his, it was a cousin of his, who was actually the guy who met with Reagan, and he described exactly what the man had told Reagan, and Reagan believed it. And so Reagan had the two goals, and he got both of them basically done. He took out the Soviet Union, and he lowered marginal tax rates. And beyond that, Reagan really wasn't committed to any particular plan, but he was focused on what he wanted to do. And I'm very grateful that he was able to do both of them. The reality is, though, in areas of vetoing, he almost never vetoed any spending plan.
Yeah,
and
right.
The deficit got enormous under him and has never turned back.
Right, and we're in agreement, though, that Reagan was at least a bit of a maverick, and it says something good about our society yet, that it's open enough politically that the powers that be needn't be displaced by, shall we say, violent means or revolution, but nonviolent methods can work. Okay, we'll be back with Gary Norris on the other side of the break. I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim today, tomorrow, and Thursday. I have some wonderful guests, and today we're talking with Dr. Gary Norris, the financial guru, among other talents. Gary, I had a mailing I just received here a week or so ago with an excerpt from an old essay from Henry Hazlitt, the wonderful economic journalist from the Mises Institute. And in this excerpt or essay, Hazlitt argued, and I just want to get your reaction to this, that money, the money system is the key to just about everything, or it's the number one issue. For example, you mentioned the $3.1 trillion budget. It's kind of choked on that word, that it's a budget, but and these enormous deficits, even when we're high in the business cycle, or it is relative prosperity, and So how could they get away with this if you actually had a gold, silver, hard money system? Could they engage in these wars and these enormous spending projects?
Well, it would certainly be. They would have to convince the public constantly of the necessity for this expansion of government power and government spending. The sales job would be enormously more difficult. If a country is attacked, yeah, I think that's true. I think you can get the troops to rally if you're being invaded.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about the building of an empire the way Britain was, I don't think the British Empire could have expanded to the extent that it did expand if it hadn't been for the Bank of England writing the checks.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
In terms of the creation of an empire today, I think the central bank is the central institution that makes that expansion possible.
So its demise and replacement by a sound money system, as you say, would just increase their sales job, their psyop, their mind control problem tremendously.
Yeah, I think they would not be able to do it. I just don't think it would be possible. You did not have any really successful move of the United States beyond what we picked up in the Spanish-American War. But you did not see that kind of expansion thereafter until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Then you began to see this enormous expansion of government power into every nook and cranny of our lives. So Hazlitt, I think, is correct that if you had a sound money system, you really would put them under manacles, golden manacles, if that's how you want to look at it.
Right.
In which we as individuals would have the power to say no simply by going down to the banks and saying, we're cashing in, we want our gold coins. But
right.
that has not been possible in the West since about 1914.
Let me change gears a bit here. I want to come back to the whole political economy situation and then maybe close out with your personal advice that we can get cheaper than on your website, although I recommend the website. You mentioned weaponized anthrax as a possible terror event, a major catastrophe in the United States. Now, today, this book by the New York Times reporter Philip Shannon came out officially. It's The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Commission. And at least the lead item is that the executive director, Philip Zelikow, of the 9/11 Commission, this is really shocking news, was in close touch with the White House, Karl Rove in particular. And, of course, it was already well known that he was a sidekick of Condoleezza Rice. What this sets up the whole thing of, you know, our so-called war. Well, we are in real wars, but the war on the Muslim world, the global domination project, or otherwise called the war on terror. You early on had a couple of articles about 9/11 that raised questions about the official story right away, within a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, one of them that made me extremely suspicious, that the airlines would not release the names of any of the accused terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's name was listed, but not one name on any of the airlines was listed with respect to those people who were presumably the ones who had engineered the suicide attacks. Now, that made it extremely doubtful in my mind that they were being straight with us. Then what really got me, Morgan, was this.
Now, you were the guy, really, that said, hey, these passenger manifests don't have any Arab or Muslim names.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so then within a matter of days, almost a matter of hours, there was this complete list published by the FBI of the people who had supposedly engineered this. And what struck me is that over following months, you had several of these guys who were accused of having been on board showing up, still alive. And so that becomes really a suspicious operation, I thought. So
though the mainstream media, I can reaffirm, they reported 10, with no real follow-up, but within the first week or two, major mainstream media reported 10 of the 19 accused as being alive.
Yeah, it was certainly over one. And all it takes, the old rule is if you get just one dead man showing up, probably there's suspicion about the others. Morgan, if I had my druthers, of course I'm doing this as an historian, but I'll tell you what I'd tell your friends who work on this. What I would like to see is a 9/11 site that would be exclusively devoted to one thing, and that is what could not have happened physically.
Now,
just that. Don't give me the theories of what did happen. Close off the dead ends of what could not conceivably have happened. Now, I believe that if you had a site like that with links and verification, you would blow gigantic holes into the standard account of the attack.
That's a great idea. Actually, I think I'm the man well-equipped to do that. I actually have a federal court case that basically says NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology contractors, participated in a fraud. It's a so-called Key Tam case. And one thing that is very suspicious is how little airplane debris there was at all four sites. And then you go down this path, how could an aluminum plane, regardless of speed, given Newton's laws of motion, possibly disappear into a tower? It's just, it cannot happen. So there, I think that's a great idea.
The main thing in this is it does create doubt, which is fine, but then it closes off the dead end so we don't spend our time going down them.
There is a historian here who's interested in efficiency. I love that as an economist. So we will rejoin Gary Norris on the other side of the break. And I'll be here tomorrow and on Thursday with some more interesting talk. My guest today is Gary Norris, a prolific and wonderful writer. He's a PhD historian, a financial advisor, and a big picture guy that is also good with the details. Let's go back to this anthrax issue, Gary, where you were talking about the risk of a future attack. Of course, I recall shortly after 9/11, there were some five victims of a weaponized anthrax attack. And if you believe, as I do, that 9/11 was an inside job, this is a pretty good disciplinary follow-up, and among other things, it said to the rest of the country, be afraid, be very afraid, you could open a letter and die. But some of the victims here were real interesting, like the National Enquirer guy, Bob Stevens, and it went to some leading Democrats on Capitol Hill and then some major news media. And that thing just petered out. The FBI supposedly was undertaking this investigation with hundreds of agents involved, and Dr. Stephen Hatfield was the big candidate, and for sure it came from this weaponized anthrax was not your ordinary street powder, apparently. It all originated from Fort Detrick, Maryland. And therefore, you would have had a handful of suspects, and nothing came of it. So what went on there, Gary?
Well, with respect to that one, that Fort Detrick story was a fascinating story, and you're right, it was stopped. The investigation seems to have been completely stopped. So you've got, it's one of those cases where you get a trail started and then there's a dead end at the end of the trail.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is this. We have got, and by the way, I posted this scenario within a week, I think, of 9/11. And the reason I did it, and it was on the Lou Rockwell site, is that many years ago, in the about 1987, I think, 87, I worked with a guy named Dr. Arthur Robinson, a chemist and first-rate scientist. And he and I were concerned about nuclear attack, and so we wrote a book on civil defense. And one of the aspects of that study was the threat of biological warfare as well as simply nuclear warfare. And he continued in that study. He's a first-rate researcher in this area as a biochemist. And he told me prior, several years prior to the 9/11 attack, that for something in the range of $25,000 to $30,000, that a good biochemist with two graduate assistants, if they had a year to synthesize the anthrax from publicly available sources, that with approximately a minivan of the anthrax for which they would have inoculated themselves, that if they released that close to a major city, if the wind was blowing in the right direction, that within 48 hours, as many as half of the population of that city would be dead and the city would be uninhabitable. And he said, I mean, he assured me this was realistic, and I verified it with him before I went public. Now, that cannot be traced to a country, and that really cannot be monitored very effectively mm-hmm. by any kind of defensive agency. And the problem is it could be a true crackpot revolutionary group that did it. You could say it would be Muslim, but how would you prove it?
How did they prove 9/11 was Muslim?
But I'll tell you, if they did it, for example, they released that in New York City, and then let's assume they gave a spam warning saying another city is going to be hit within 48 hours, the potential for creating chaos is almost monumental, because it would be enormous, especially if they happen to hit the city 48 hours later, then you'd really have it. And you could take out New York City, central London, where the banking system is, Frankfurt and Tokyo. The West effectively would be taken out in terms of its ability to conduct business, because the banks would go down. Now, I see that as a threat, because in terms of cost efficiency, it is so extraordinarily dangerous in terms of the amount of money and time it would cost to do it versus the effects of it. It's unthinkable, and yet you have to think about it. Now, I don't have any solution for it except one, and the solution is stop meddling in the affairs of Islamic countries. That's the only solution I can recommend.
Or terminate our intelligence services and military-industrial complex that Dwight D. Eisenhower warned of. You know, one of the other peculiar set of facts here following 9/11 was that some three dozen biochemists in the world died under mysterious circumstances.
Yes,
one of them was quite nearby here where I live, in near Little Rock, Arkansas. There's some odd things going on there.
Yes, I remember reading about that. That was extremely scary, and it got no publicity at all.
Well, let me change subjects again here, and we've already mentioned the powers that be, those mysterious forces, but we all know big money talks and basically can lead power by the nose. And big money, international money in particular. And then we have the PTB issue. We also have another three-letter word, NWO, or acronym, New World Order. And some people in this part of the intellectual, political circles in the United States believe, for example, that the powers that be now pursuing the New World Order, traditionally or historically, finance both sides. In other words, every wars especially are wonderful things for the powers that be, allegedly, and every dollar the government spends and or borrows is received by somebody. And so what should we think about all of that, Gary?
Well, obviously, if you can lend to a desperate borrower for long-term debt and create the money out of nothing, it's a very profitable operation.
And being the middleman, yeah. Yes. Great. Gary and Norris and Morgan Reynolds, with the new dynamic duo, will be back after the commercial break coming up. Gary, the New World Order, powers that be, we were just discussing, and one of the names that pops into my mind here to give you a different spin on this is that, pardon? Okay, thanks. David Ray Griffin is a leading authority on 9/11 from the dissident or skeptical point of view, and he actually is nonetheless a proponent of the New World Order, who makes the following basic argument. He says, democracy is a good thing in the USA. Why isn't it a good thing in the world? So he doesn't have any seeming loyalty to the idea of a constitutional republic with a small, limited government. So the New World Order seems to sell in various quarters, regardless of where you might stand on 9/11. What about that, Dr. North?
Well, there's no doubt. By the way, you may hear a slight different sound coming from me, and that is, we have gone into the bathroom because the weather service says that in our area there's a tornado on the ground.
Oh, really?
So if this is, I don't think it's part of the New World Order, but at least we're under an alert. So if you lose me, we did lose power briefly. So don't be surprised if all of a sudden I just go off one.
Well, I hope the bad guys are not micromanaging tornadoes now.
Yeah, that's certainly the goal. My attitude on that, obviously, the push towards this international regime, it's been going on. You can date it. I mean, easily take it back to pre-World War I with Jean Monnet and all of the work that he was doing, and certainly after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
This push is not something that happened day before yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long-term goal. And basically it boils down to if people see that you can centralize power in one state, why not extend it across the borders and gain total control? And so I don't think that push is going to go away anytime soon. What we have to do is make certain as much as we possibly can that Americans are alert to it and pressure Congress not to allow that kind of destruction of our borders and destruction of our national sovereignty. And if the public screams loud enough and said, we're going to vote against you, if you don't vote against this, they do listen. But it's when the public is asleep at the wheel that they can get away with it.
Let's go to the, we seem to be at a turning point or in a point of economic crisis where the buoyancy, the seeming artificial growth, overconsumption, and malinvestment or bad investments are coming home to roost. So what are we to think about? Is that a correct diagnosis? And what does the near-term economic future look like?
Well, I see recession. Of course, I've been saying recession for probably 6 months that I thought it was virtually in the pipeline. I guess now, especially after today's debacle, that is more widely viewed, because the basic thing that came out, the statistic that came out, is from the Institute for Supply Management, and theirs is when it goes below 50% for the service sector, it's considered recessionary. That thing dropped from 54 last month to under 42 this
wow.
month. It was the largest, fastest drop that I have ever seen in the history of the reporting of that statistic. It's unprecedented. Well, I mean, the Dow dropped 370 points as a result of it, for good reason. I mean, if ISM says that you've gone that far negative that fast, this, we're now in the stage, according to their statistic, as October of 2001, which was during the recession of 2001, and this is only month one. You know, we've dropped that fast. So I think we're headed into a recession. I think you're going to see bankruptcies of bond insurance firms. I think you could even lose some major banks, or at least get into a crisis where the Federal Reserve is going to have to intervene. Now, as that fear spreads, I think you're going to see unemployment rising. I think you're going to see really extensive fear of consumers. Maybe they're finally going to save a little bit. That'd be good. They sure don't otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think that the Greenspan bubbles are about to pop. That's now, of course, at some point, the Fed will have to intervene strongly and reinflate the system. But that could be a year. It could be 18 months. You don't. This is like a huge ocean liner. You don't turn around in a short period of time or space. So I am pessimistic with respect to the next 12 to 18 months. I think you're going to get into a recession. I don't think it's going to be a 2001 recession. I think we're going to be happy if we can keep it to a 1991 recession. It might get as bad as it was in 81 under Reagan. And most people in the financial world have forgotten about that experience. I remember it, but a lot of the newcomers don't remember it.
Yeah, I think the NBER had that as a double recession.
Yes, they did. Yes. Yeah, they did.
And what a recession, despite the we'll call it the pain of adjustment to a lot more reality than was true during the boom, is a way of getting healthy, isn't it? And,
sure.
And reestablishing the preconditions for sound growth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But the difficulty is, let's face it, pain is now, you want to take away the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody says, I mean, a guy who's on the battlefield who's been shot or really badly hurt, and they give him morphine, if that continues, it's conceivable he could become addicted. That is possible, and we have become addicted to fiat money. That's what's happened.
Right.
And every time they slow down the growth of fiat money, we get into withdrawal symptoms, and we don't like it.
Right. More of the drug. More of the drug.
More of the drug. And unfortunately,
and of course, all you're doing is buying a bigger future cataclysm.
Yeah. That's right.
The distortions just multiply and are accentuated and grow bigger. Now, of course, people are going to start shifting toward more saving and less consumption expenditures, if only because the house inflation, the big ATM that you live in, is no longer going to work for you.
Yeah, that's right. We are seeing the first time, well, certainly in my adult lifetime, that nationally housing prices are falling. I don't think it's happened since the 1930s, but it's certainly never in my lifetime and as an adult over the past 45 years have we seen nationally housing prices falling. Now, you can get a loan. You can refinance your house if you have equity in it and if you have a very high credit rating and if you have a job that clearly is going to enable you to pay back the loan. So it's not that you can't get credit if you're a first-rate borrower, but the average guy isn't.
Yes, the loan standards have been reestablished, haven't they? They seem to be non-existent there for a few years. Okay, we're going to get personal financial advice, or I'm going to try and get it from Dr. Gary North about what you should do to minimize the damage during this coming recession. Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where we're ready to help. We've got Dr. Gary North, who's going to give us some financial self-preservation advice, I hope. The Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer is usually here the rest of the week, Tuesday through Thursday. I'm your guest host today, Morgan Reynolds. Okay, Gary, we seem to have the same opinion about the economy. This recession is likely to be a lot more serious than the two shallow ones we had in 01 and back in 91, more like the serious stuff at the outset of the Reagan administration following the Carter administration. It's likely to be a little deeper than the shallow recession. So what can our listeners do to protect themselves best from what is unfolding?
Well, the first step that I would recommend, if a listener has a 401k or if he has an IRA of some form where he is in a position to administer or at least on an emergency basis a couple of times a year to switch what he invests in,
mm-hmm.
I would say move out of the stocks, even especially if you're in 60 or 70%, absolutely lighten up on the stocks. I would say it would be wise just to be out of the stock market at this time. I would move it to a money market fund. If nothing else, at least you don't take a hit, which is important. Some people who, if they really can administer, and usually they can't, usually they don't have much say, but I think it would be a wise thing to be with at least a portion of that money into an international fund, not a stock fund, but either a bond fund or a money market fund denominated in foreign currencies with at least part of that money. Don't bet the whole pony. Don't bet the whole lot on the same pony because he may stumble. And the dollar could have a serious decline in relationship to those other currencies. But I think it would be extremely...
But if you were in an international bond fund, you would gain by the depreciation of the dollar.
Yeah, I think it would be much wiser to be in an international bond fund than to be in the U.S. stock market, or any stock market for that matter. I think they're unitized. I don't think that China or any of them, if the U.S. goes into a serious recession, I don't think any international stock market is going to be immune from that decline. So I think
that's an important point. There really is no diversification when the storm is at your door.
No.
The international diversification argument doesn't work.
Not if it's in equities. No, I don't
right.
think so. So that would, I mean, that's for the guy who really has a big chunk of his money tied up into equities. I think discretion is the better part of valor. And save your, if you think you're really going to get rich in American stocks, try to get rich when the Dow is at, say, 5,000 instead of where it is today. Now, the second thing I would do, and this really is more important, and this applies to almost anybody who's listening, and that is, if your business is dependent on any supply line of credit, you had better be sure that that business has got a secure line of credit if rollovers keep that business alive. Now, I went through the crisis in the mid-'80s in Texas, and banks that had very good relationships with long-term customers and who would roll over those loans, all of a sudden the bank was bankrupt. A new banking agency bought the bank, and the new guys coming in said, we don't know you, we're not giving you any loans, goodbye. And companies that had existed for years with a secure line of credit, that if they didn't have it in writing that they could borrow,
mm-hmm.
they were dead, and it didn't have anything to do with the general economy that they were facing in the marketplace. It had to do with their line of credit. Now, the next thing you got to do is, if you're on commission, if you sell into a commission market, you're going to have to expect long hours and reduced income because people are going to tighten up on what they're going to buy. So you better start saving. You better get that 6 months of liquid assets in your bank or in some money market fund or somewhere where if your income drops by 20 or 30% as a result of the recession, that you don't lose your home. You don't lose your car, you don't lose whatever it is that's on the line. So you've got to be flexible, and you've got to have some reserves, and now is the time to get those reserves. The next thing is, if you're not on commission, don't assume that you cannot be fired. And whatever you can do to make certain that you are so valuable to your company that they just would not fire you, you are so important to them, or at least they think you're so important to them, That's the killer. Guys say, gee, I might lose 20, 30, 40% of my stock investment. If you lose your job in a recession, it could set back your career 10 years. So you have got to pay very, very good attention to what your company is facing, and you've got to be absolutely certain that of any guy in the company that they are not going to fire, that's you.
Yeah, if you do keep your job, I think back to the Great Depression. The people, the three-quarters of the workforce in the aggregate that kept their jobs actually did quite well, thank you very much.
Yeah, they did. But the devastation to the 25% who didn't and what they lost scarred them for the rest of their lives.
Oh, yes.
So, again, those would be the what you've got to look at. If you're serious about this, if you're a listener out there and you wonder, what are you going to do, assume that you aren't going to get rich over the next 13 or 14 months unless you really guts you and you short the market. Now, you can do that, and for some of your money, it probably would be a good idea.
Yeah, I do that at least on a smaller scale.
On a small scale, I think that you go to Barrex or you go to any of the funds that short the market and
right.
and at least protect yourself.
Pro Ultra Short or Barrex, yeah.
But don't try to get rich on the downside. Just be solvent when the thing bottoms. That's when you make your money, is that you have liquidity, you have money to make investments, and you have the job that's solid at the bottom of the recession. That's when you're going to make money. If you're going to make it, that's when you ought to plan to make it. So right now, batten down the hatches and get liquid and get in a position where you are defended if in case you do lose your job.
Well, that's an interesting angle I want to pick up on, and that is when everybody's depressed, the market is dogging it, let's say the Dow would go to 5,000, and these bottoms are kind of long-lived. You don't have to catch the falling knife and all that, right? And when everybody's depressed and doesn't see any way out, that's the time to buy.
Yeah, that is the time to buy. So let's put it this way. If you're confident in your job, you're doing a good job, you think, and you better be sure, but you think your company is probably immune to the cycle, like you're in healthcare, for example, something of that nature, batten down the hatches. Don't get panicked.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this is not a time to think greed.
Mm-hmm.
This is a time to think safety. There's plenty of time for greed later on.
Okay, well, greed leads me to what about the two precious metals? Well, we could throw in platinum, et cetera. How do you expect those to fare, as well as the stocks of these, the mining companies, the producers?
Well, today the mining shares were down almost 4%. Stocks were, the bullion was down about 1.5. Personally, I think you always should have metals, because in a crisis you need metals for the same reason you need anything else that keeps you going. I have strongly told my people, don't be in the shares, be in the actual bullion or the coins. That is to say, it's less volatile, it's less likely to fall in a crisis. The basic problem is this. If the mining company is doing well at a nice high price, but of course costs keep going up, they got to pay for labor, they got to pay for all the things that they buy to keep the doors open, then if gold falls, their costs will not fall as fast as the metal can fall.
Oh, no.
And at that point, right, you'd better be in the metal and not the stock.
Yeah, that's been my inclination. I've got a financial management son who likes the stocks, but I guess he's a younger gambler than I am.
Yeah, he's younger. He can afford the loss. You can't.
And that's it. I thank my special guest, Dr. Gary Norris, for his wonderful insights and advice on financial self-preservation. I'll be here tomorrow. Morgan Reynolds on the Dynamic Duo.